From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Gabe Albinos, who is the president of the Montgomery County Council. Joining us now is Jordan Pascal. He is WMU's transportation reporter. Jordan, thank you very much for joining us.
Good afternoon, Tom and Kojo.
And if you want to know why Jordan Pascal is a guest, well, he's got nothing else to do, so he decided he would drop it. No, we'll be talking about the upcoming retirement of the head of Metro, Paul Wiedefeld. But first, Tom Sherwood, let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in Virginia. Governor Glenn Youngkin was inaugurated last week, and he wasted no time at all in making a couple of executive orders, one of them ending mask mandates in schools. Talk about that.
Well, he's in his first week as governor, and he's running into some surprises. He ordered in this executive order that there will be no school mask mandates around the Commonwealth, and more than like a dozen jurisdictions said, hey, hold on a minute. The law says we're supposed to follow the
Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC.
Right, yeah, the federal guidelines to the maximum extent possible, and that's what they're going to do. So many local jurisdictions, Arlington, Alexandria, Manassas, Richmond, Prince William, have all said they're going to continue the mask mandates. And Chesapeake City, which is down near Norfolk, parents down there sued and said, look, we're not going to just give up on our mask. Our children's safety is at stake. So it's gotten quite the pushback. I'm not quite sure how it's going to end.
You know, during the campaign, Glenn Youngkin pointed out that he has been vaccinated and boosted and he wears a mask, but he doesn't think that other people should be forced to wear it, that it should be a matter of choice. We'll have to see what happens there. He has also chosen his diversity officer and changed the name of the diversity office. Talk about that.
Okay, Angela Snyder. She's been at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He appointed her to his cabinet as the director of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. However, he has changed the name of that office to the Office of Diversity, Opportunity, and Inclusion, switching out equity for opportunity.
Why?
Well, equity now is kind of a political buzzword for conservatives who don't like it and progressive Democrats who do. And it's another nod to the conservative base that elected him in the November election. Equity means different things to different people, even if you read it correctly in the dictionary. And another big change he's making in there, in addition to saying opportunity, he said that that Angela Snyder, as the director of this Office of Diversity, will be, quote, the ambassador to unborn children. Another nod to the conservative anti-abortion groups that helped elect him.
Is it Angela Snyder or Angela Saylor?
Did I miswrite it? I wrote it down.
Oh, no. The piece was in the Washington Post was by Gregory Snyder.
Oh, I could.
Her name is Angela Saylor.
Well, thank you. That's the first mistake of 2022 for me that I'm aware of.
Well, I was happening to be reading it at the same time that you were saying it. Otherwise,
everything else I said was correct.
Everything he always says is
correct. My apologies for getting the names wrong. Names are important.
Our transportation reporter at WMU, Jordan Pascal, is joining us. We're hoping to have CEO Paul Wiedefeld at some time, hopefully in the near future. But Jordan, Wiedefeld announced that he's retiring. He's going to leave his position in 6 months. What reasons did he give, or did he or the transit agency give for his departure?
Well, Wiedefeld has been in the job for 6 years, and he's also 66, so certainly in the time and position in life to retire. He told media that Metro is facing a seismic shift in the coming years, a lot of long-term issues with riders back to the system and perhaps maybe more staying home and working remotely. There's also an upcoming fiscal cliff in 2024. So he says someone else is going to have to make those decisions. He doesn't want to be there for that long to be in charge charge of those long decisions. But, you know, a lot of people have the 7000 series train issue on their mind. Those wheel issues prompted the sidelining of those trains. And, you know, some people thought that might have been related. But board members say Wiedefeld was not forced out. They said he decided it was his time to step down.
Tom Sherwood, I remember the glory years when the woman I called the sainted Carmen Turner ran Metro from 1983 to 1997 years, during which everything that you seem to read and hear about Metro in those days was praise. It was expanding. It grew to 70 million riders a year. What happened?
Well, first I want to thank Jordan for being on the show, but to let him know that at 66, Paul Wiedefeld doesn't want to retire. There are many people working well past 66, some of whom are in this room. And he did decide, though, that this was somebody new, fresh eyes needed to be in charge of Metro, because the next couple of years are going to be very difficult as it still tries to bring back the ridership that it needs. But, you know, he did do a lot of things. He came in 2015, as Jordan knows, and he settled down an administration that was not doing well. There had been horrific crashes, the fire that killed a woman, and lots of different things. He and some board members, including, I might say, Jack Evans from the district, pressured Congress and the local jurisdictions to add more money to Metro. That's been done, but the COVID pandemic has been a terrific blow to many people. And frankly, I think Paul Wiedefeld is joining the Great Resignation.
Indeed, I'd like to hear your view on his tenure. Also, Jordan, what do you see as his greatest accomplishments and his biggest challenges?
Yeah, well, like Tom said, you know, he came in kind of with a splash in 2016. One of his first few actions in his first few months was shutting down the entire system for a full day after he found out there was power cable issues, and they shut down the whole system and inspected the whole thing. That irked a lot of commuters, but was applauded by a lot of safety officials. But I kind of look at Wiedefeld's tenure in kind of, I don't know, three or four different eras, the second being SafeTrack, which was a major push from the summer of 2016 to 2017. They crammed 3 years of maintenance backlog into one, but that program shut down multiple stretches of track throughout the year and caused tons of headaches for riders, but certainly got a lot done. Then, as Tom also mentioned, in 2018, he helped secure dedicated funding for Metro from the region's three jurisdictions, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, which is certainly a big lift, and got Metro a lot of money that it needed for capital and maintenance projects. But, you know, I moved here in 2018 and, you know, had read about these, you know, major issues from afar. I would say for maybe a year or two, there was a slight renaissance, I guess. You know, they were, you know, extending hours at night, you know, trying to provide more service. You know, I think people were maybe slightly more satisfied in those years. Ridership was certainly increasing, and there was, I think, maybe some optimism. But then, you know, this era of the pandemic hit, and, you know, the trans agency took a really big hit. A lot of people staying home. You know, he's managing a workforce that's sick. A lot of drastic and difficult proposals to cut service. You may remember, you know, at times they proposed no weekend train service, closing 20 stations. Obviously, the federal government came in and saved them with federal money relief. And then the last era here in the last few months with the 7000 series trains derailment and sidelining, those are going to be offline for 6 months all in. And there's still some real questions about, you know, who knew what, when, why the problem was allowed to kind of fester and grow. And, you know, those investigations are ongoing, but certainly will be a part of his legacy.
Yeah, he said in his statement that there are seismic shifts in transit and that the system needs a leader who can commit to several years, something he couldn't do. You know, one of the big issues of this commuter rail system is that if the federal government continues to allow its employees in mass numbers to work from home several days a week, it could be a real hit to Metro, because the Metro Rail is 40% federal workers. And we haven't even discussed the bus system. Yeah. There's one of the great complaints or irritations or fears about Metro is that it hasn't unified the region. Maryland, Virginia, D.C. are all doing different bus programs, but they really need to up the buses, because while the buses took a hit, more people are back riding buses each day. And I don't know, maybe Jordan, you know, how the buses are doing, given what's happening.
Yeah, you're right. Bus ridership is higher than rail ridership right now. And you're right, you know, there's also a lot of regional transit agencies in Montgomery County, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there was a push in 2019 from some business groups and other advocates called the Bus Transformation Project, which was looking holistically about how to improve transit in the region. That kind of fell by the wayside during the pandemic, but they're making a big push to kind of bring that conversation back to the forefront.
There's not a big pool of people who can be the head of Metro. Do you have a sense of the board, or I guess we'll meet next week and figure out how it's going to proceed with its job search, but there really isn't a big pool of people who can step into this job.
Jordan?
No, I mean, and I was, Tom, you're right. I think, you know, I've heard from a lot of different politicians and transit advocates. I mean, you're in a unique position where not only do you have to be an administrator of 12,000 employees, you have to, you know, almost be a politician working among, you know, all these jurisdictions. You have to have safety at the forefront. You're right. There's not many people that are equipped to do such a big job. In the past, I was reading about old general managers. You know, Wiedefeld came from airports and other transportation stuff. You know, the first general manager, Jackson Graham, was, you know, head of Army Corps Engineers. The second one was a bean counter. He was 31 from the federal government. So, I mean, there's really interesting, you know, wide range of experience. But I certainly think, you know, somebody that has transit experience is really important at this point.
What have the responses been to Wiedefeld stepping down from his role? We got one from Thaddeus who tweeted, "Paul Wiedefeld should have gotten the boot years ago." I am not quite sure that is a widespread sentiment. But what do you know, Jordan Pascal?
You know, it's interesting because I think, you know, a lot of the establishment politicians, people that work with Wiedefeld, were very happy with his performance. There was a lot of thanks and praise. You know, Governor Larry Hogan noted that Metro is an enormous job and it will take a transformative leader to kind of keep things moving in the right direction. Metro's largest union, ATU Local 689, said, you know, they initially really butted heads with Wiedefeld, but had a better working relationship in recent years. They hope to see, you know, someone that can work with them in the future. But I have heard that sentiment from riders, like you mentioned. Some are saying, you know, good riddance, Paul.
Well, I think those, you know, people, anyone who says good riddance doesn't know the slightest thing about Metro, may be quite frustrated with their own travel opportunities on Metro. But, you know, whoever
for
gets
sure.
the new job, whoever gets that job, is going to have to face maybe some would say a bloated Metro workforce, changing nature of transit. It's just going to be extraordinary, and it's going to be quite the political decision who gets hired.
Here's Lawrence in Washington, D.C. Lawrence, your turn.
Yes, so I have a concern about the Metro Access Service. My mother-in-law died a while back, and we had an advance on payment for services, and in trying to recover that, I was told that the office in Hyattsville has been closed with, and that's where I was told to mail a refund request. And so I called back just recently, and I was told that I couldn't talk to anybody directly about that, but one of the agents said, well, if you send me the email, I can forward it to the appropriate person. And it just seems kind of very convoluted that it has to be done that way. Metro Access is a very...
There have always been problems with Metro Access, but Jordan, I don't know if you know about this particular one.
Well, sorry for your loss, but I think Metro has had, especially with this Omicron surge lately, I mean, they've shut down the Lost and Found office because of Omicron. They have, you know, cut back on bus service. I think, you know, the illness is really spreading throughout their ranks. So I'm not sure if exactly specifically that office, but we haven't even mentioned Metro Access and how much of a lifeline and a service that is for, you know, people that, you know, can't use the bus or rail. It's a door-to-door service that is super essential for a lot of people.
And we haven't mentioned the 7000 series. We don't have a lot of time left here, but last week Metro announced that the 7000 series trains won't return until at least mid-April. What's the reason for this latest delay?
Well, you know, Metro's been going back and forth on this. The latest thing that they said is that they need to get to the root cause of the issue. In recent weeks, Metro said it would measure the distance between the wheels every single day on every single 7000 series trains. Now they're looking at other solutions like technology in the tracks that can measure the wheels as the trains are running, but that will take time to install, and it will also take time to get to the bottom of what's causing the wheels to move apart in the first place.
But is it
those wheels moving apart? Okay.
Excuse me, Jordan. There is some concern people I've spoken with about Metro is that the 7000 series, which I think is 60% of the rail service, may never come back.
Correct. You know, I've heard that. Because it is such a large part of the fleet, I mean, they're going to have to at some point. They're going to have to figure out something, whether it's replacing every single wheel set or this, you know, constant measuring and, you know, replacing as needed. But it's too large of an investment and too big a part of the system to just throw away, I believe. I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but it just seems like unlikely.
Could be later than April, at least.
Well, after
Correct.
6 years,
yeah, come
the
back.
CEO mm-hmm. of Metro, Paul Wiedefeld, is stepping away. You know, Jordan, Tom Sherwood knows the real reason that Paul Wiedefeld is stepping away, but he won't tell you. I will. It's because Tom's sidekick has been offered on several occasions by Paul Wiedefeld to become the voice of Metro and turned him down on several occasions. And I think Wiedefeld just can't take that kind of rejection anymore.
You know, I've heard that. And that, Kojo, I think you would be a good voice of Metro.
Doors closing.
And Tom,
step
too.
Back.
Doors closing on that and other things.
Step back, Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now is Gabe Albanos. He is the president of the Montgomery County Council. Gabe Albanos, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Kojo. I, for one, would love to hear your voice on Metro. That sounds pretty cool.
Wait till the end of this program. And
only
see.
On the good days when the trains are running well. Before we get to Montgomery County, Tom Sherwood, let's talk about the district a little bit. First, politics, your specialty. You broke the story that Harry Thomas Jr., the former Ward 5 council member who was running for that seat, again has decided that he will not run for that seat. How come?
Well, he didn't get any support. He couldn't even report money raised in the January reporting or December reporting thing. Harry Thomas, as people may remember, is a Ward 5 council member who resigned in 2012 because he pled guilty to charges of federal charges of defrauding the district out of $350,000 that was money intended for youth programs. A particularly terrible thing for him to have done. He went off to prison. He's come back. He's been trying to raise his profile in the Ward 5. Last November, he announced he would be seeking a seat again, but just didn't catch fire in any way. And then this week, a forum announced that he wasn't going to be there because he's not going to run anymore. So I called him up and asked him. He said, that's right, he's going to run instead for the shadow representative seat to Congress for statehood, which pays nothing. But in the course of doing that, he put out a brochure that turned out to be plagiarized, the Georgetowner editorial about statehood, and he had to apologize for that. And he says, I don't want anybody thinking I'm trying to steal their work. Well, you know, he stole all that money. He's still paying back. He didn't get off the ground for his council seat. I think he's going to maybe have a hard time on the statehood effort, too. Part of the past. Ward 5 has already changed. It's significantly different than it was back in 2012.
We'll have to see what happens. D.C. substitute teachers are not happy, even though they've gotten a raise from Mayor Muriel Bowser. They're going to be earning $136 a day, which is about a $15 increase from their current daily pay. But what they wanted was $300 a day because they knew that retired teachers who were asked to return as substitute teachers were getting $300 a day. And so they're like, what's wrong with us? How come we can't get that?
Well, you know, every school system is having trouble recruiting and retaining substitute teachers during this COVID thing. But this seemed a particularly low amount of money. The mayor stepped forward and said, you know, they were complaining about their pay, so we're going to give them an increase. But the increase was so small, it's about $2 an hour. I've said that's not enough to buy $2 Chuck wine.
And when the minimum raise goes up to $16.10 an hour, that'll be about where they are.
All right, so $2 an hour really is not that much when it was already going to go up in the summer anyway. So they're frustrated. The school system is frustrated. They're going to try to have a weekly demonstration or something to complain about it, but they really do need, they say, more money, more realistic money, and it's just hard to hire substitutes now, so I think the district may have to look at this again.
And let's go to Marilyn now, because she hasn't been able to be a guest on the show for these last few years since she hadn't been in office, former Congresswoman Donna Edwards is running again. As I said, her whole purpose is to get back on the show, but talk a little bit about
why.
Well,
you know, she tried out at MSNBC, and she wasn't very good. Now, she actually was quite good on that program. And, you know, she was five terms from the 4th District in Maryland. Anthony Brown has held that seat. He's giving it up to run for Attorney General. So she could be, she's joining former State's Attorney Glenn Ivey, Delegate Jazz Lewis.
Former state delegate Angela Angel.
Angela Angel just got in, and so it's going to be an interesting race. She certainly has the name recognition. It will be interesting to see what she does to put fire back into her politics.
Council President Albanos, are you going to endorse anybody in that race?
Probably not, but that is an impressive pool of candidates to say the least. So I think that district will be in good hands no matter who wins.
Can we ask him right off the bat here as we start this program?
I figured this was coming.
That the this is about the schools. There's a walkout today.
This was about an endorsement for politics.
Well, it is. I'm going to get to the endorsement because I know he's not going to endorse anyone because he's the president of the council for this year. He's got to maintain an even hand. I know all the answers already. But the students, I don't know how successful it is, but at noon, like in a dozen or more schools, the high school students were going to walk out because they're dissatisfied with the COVID safety precautions and they want some more distant learning. I know you're not in charge of the school system, but what are you hearing about that walkout?
Well, I know that there's just tremendous frustration all the way around, both from the administration itself, teachers, support staff, principals, families. It's been a rough month at MCPS, and you know they're experiencing what school jurisdictions across the country are experiencing, which is just this crushing challenges related to Omicron, both the spread, but also just the sheer volume of support staff and teachers that are going down. And we're experiencing that operationally across all of our county agencies, but MCPS in particular has really taken it on the chin. And I know there have been many concerns regarding even the quality of education within the school day because of, you know, how many teachers, and in your previous segment, you talked about substitute teachers, which is a problem in Montgomery County as well. So I certainly understand and respect the frustration. I know the school system's doing everything that it can and working closely with our HHS department, but I do very much respect that frustration being felt by students. I'm not surprised by it.
Let me follow up a question. The interim school superintendent, Dr. McKnight, has said that she will mark the students who are out on the protest as unauthorized absence. This is a kind of a public demonstration. Do you think that's the right thing to do?
I can't speak for the school system or the Board of Education because I know they have their own policies and procedures. I can only say that as a youth development worker myself, I always think it's really important for youth to have their voices heard. And we know that they've experienced so much socially and emotionally these last 2 years. The last thing I think that we want to do right now is add on top of that. I understand the school system stance and there's policies that they have to practice, but we also have to take into account what our kids have been experiencing these last 2 years and use that as our guide as well.
You're a parent of school kids, aren't you?
I am. Yeah. So I've seen it firsthand, the frustration felt by our kids. We have four all under the age of 13, and we've done everything that we can to support them in every way that we can. But we're fortunate in our household to have an extended support structure that a lot of families don't have. And so While our kids have experienced many of the same challenges of other students, there are many more who have experienced it even worse than our kids.
Gabe Albernus is the president of the Montgomery County Council. If you have questions or comments for him, you can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org, a tweet at Politics Hour. You can reach us on Facebook at The Politics Hour, or just give us a call at 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Our guest is Gabe Albernus, the president of the Montgomery County Council. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Gabe Albernus, it seems like so many people have been affected by the coronavirus or the Omicron variant. Where do cases now stand in Montgomery County? Are we past the peak of the surge?
It does appear that we have plateaued. We plateaued late last week. The numbers have consistently been going down. The hospitalization rates have remained steady, but I think there's also a good sign. We were able to distribute hundreds of thousands of rapid test kits last week, and I think the combination of the rapid test kits, people continuing to adhere to the guidance and take necessary precautions, has helped us survive this most recent surge. But this one in particular has been very bumpy. But the numbers are consistently going down, which is good news.
County Executive Mark Elrich is out at White Oak this hour passing out masks and encouraging people to wear them and, of course, to get vaccinated. The county has done a pretty good job, though, of vaccination, has it not?
It really has. Our public health officers and officials and municipal partners have done a really great job getting the word out, making the vaccine accessible. But most of the credit goes to our citizens themselves, who have been adhering the guidance, following the science. And we are now at over 85% of our population that's eligible, has received both dosages. And we're also doing pretty well with the boosters, too. The one category that we need to bump up is the 5 to 11 category. And so we're working on that right now. It is not keeping the same pace as the other categories of children and youth that preceded them. But we're working on educating parents on the importance of the vaccination, even in children between the ages of 5 and 11. But overall, the county has done very well, especially as compared to most other jurisdictions.
County Executive Mark Elrich wants to require proof of vaccination to enter some indoor businesses like restaurants, gyms, and entertainment establishments. But at a public hearing this week, many residents and business owners vocally opposed the mandate. What have you been hearing from both sides on this issue? One gets the impression that because there's such a high vaccination rate, especially among adults in Montgomery County, they feel that this vaccination requirement is unnecessary.
Yeah, the majority of the correspondence we've received so far is negative, opposed to the proposal sent forward by the county executive, which is based on what other jurisdictions have done and follows very closely what the District of Columbia enacted last week. And of course, New York was the first major jurisdiction to move forward with this last September. So the council is in the process right now of digging into this, getting questions answered about the efficacy of it, and really also just fundamentally questioning what are the goals? Because if the goal is to enhance more vaccinations, as was noted earlier, we're already doing pretty well there. So if the goal is to control spread, Omicron has really changed the paradigm. And as we know, unfortunately, even people that are fully boosted are having breakthrough cases. Now, that does mean if you are fully boosted, you're much less likely to have a severe case, but it hasn't really controlled spread. So we're working through this right now. We've had two work sessions on it. We'll have one more on Tuesday. And we've asked some fundamental logistical questions, and our business community has raised very reasonable issues.
Do you have a position on it yet?
Right now, for me at the moment, the juice is not worth the squeeze. We're going to have one more work session. We've asked a series of questions of the county executive that we're looking forward to getting responses to. But I think given our high vaccination rates and how successful we've been overall, I think we need to take a wait-and-see approach and also see how this works out with the District of Columbia. The primary concern I have is the one size fits all, because we know different places are in different positions to be able to enforce this. And we have to be reasonable, too.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. I know the county executive doesn't want to call it a passport because that sounds too restrictive and
right.
has lots of bad juice around it. But there are lots of people who, I don't know, maybe you know, how many people come into Montgomery County to work every day. And so you are part of a big region. So if you require the mandate, the District of Columbia has one now. You have to have it for in many public spaces.
Right.
But Virginia is like Wild West.
Right, right. Well, I think, you know, that's certainly an argument for it, that while our vaccination rates among residents is high, we do know that obviously many of the employees of our local businesses or people that travel within the region may not be vaccinated. So that is an argument for it. But another concern is that the order as it's currently written would require our police department to enforce this in instances that rose to that level, when somebody absolutely refused to show their proof of vaccination and caused some type of civil unrest. And I'll just be candid, you know, with the crime waves that we're revving right now, the recruitment and retention we have within law enforcement, adding yet another layer of responsibility gives me a little bit of pause. So the enforcement of this is also something that we have to take into account, and whether or not we can actually enforce it.
Here is Fred in Germantown, Maryland. Fred, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The question I have for the councilman is regarding our school community health nurses, that we had a shortage before the pandemic. We're hemorrhaging them now. It seems the school district wants them to pick up more duties, and HHS has helped help that some to try to thwart that. However, there's problems where there may be a position that is authorized, but from the time the person, the nurse who's qualified, applies to they're actually in the job can be weeks. And has so as a council, the council looked into the bureaucracy to try to decrease that time. Everybody wants to blame the system. It's like blaming the computer when things go so slow. I can't do anything. It's the
right.
computer. Can the council look into that? Because we do have some, luckily, some qualified applicants, but it's just excessive. And then again, everybody asks, well, it's the system. We can't do anything
Gabe
about
Abelman?
The system.
Well, thanks for that question, Fred. Let me just say for context that we did, you're right, have a deficit of school health nurses even before the pandemic. We did not have a school health nurse in every school in Montgomery County Public Schools. And for more context, our school health nurses are actually employees of our county's Department of Health and Human Services, not our school system. And they have performed heroically for generations, but especially these last 2 years. They were actually redeployed to help with vaccination sites, testing sites, while schools were meeting remotely. And Fred is also right that we ask too much of them. They have a tremendous level of responsibility that in some of our high schools, which are as large as small cities, is just too much to bear. So we do have to do everything we can in looking at salary and compensation. We need to look at recruiting additional nurses. And if there are administrative barriers in hiring that is making it longer to be able to onboard them, then for goodness sake, we've got to fix that because it's hard enough as it is to recruit these remarkably talented individuals. We got to get out of our own way there. So we will look into that, Fred, and I appreciate the question.
Thank you very much for your call. The school district has its own superintendent and the school board, and they make a lot of decisions about policies in schools. But we got this message from Jeff on Twitter. MCPS's commitment to staying in person is costing kids classroom time. Son's middle school classes are half full because everybody's out sick and teachers are out sick. And this idea that the county council cannot weigh in on school decisions is total hooey. And ducking responsibility. Can you explain the county council's role and maybe the county executive's roles in any decisions around schools?
Sure. Well, formal...
That's not total hooey.
No. I understand the frustration. We're hearing it from a lot of people, and I get it. I really do. But no, the Board of Education, working with the superintendent and our state Board of Education, are the ones that make individual policy decisions. And frankly, that's appropriate. The council and the county executive are several degrees removed from the operations of MCPS, and we've got a duly elected Board of Education who is made up of really dedicated women who are doing the best that they can given the circumstances, and are paid essentially a stipend, by the way, not even a salaried position, yet with the level of responsibility that they are given and the budget that they have to help oversee, it's really remarkable. Now, the council does have influence, and we also are part of this broader puzzle in addressing the pandemic, sitting as the Board of Health, to try and enact policies that that minimize the larger community levels of spread, which of course has a direct impact on our schools and other operations. And we are in constant consultation with the school system. And the moment they make a request for some type of additional budget expenditure, much more often than not, the council has stood ready to support that. We do, at a macro level, approve the school system's budget, but we do not have direct control, nor again, I believe we should, on how individual line items are decided. But it is fair to say that we are we're on the same team, and we do have influence. And I know that we've been working collaboratively, especially these last 2 weeks, and we are starting to see some improvement.
One more COVID-related question. Claire sent us an email. Why is the Western Upper County constantly forgotten in the county's COVID response? We had to fight to get the tests distributed, and now we are forgotten in the mask distribution. Our library has been closed for renovation for several months, and we have no other county facilities. What should Claire do, Gabe Albanos?
Well, she's right. Poolesville, which is what she's referring to in that region of the county, has been understandably very frustrated that they have not been able to get access to the same levels of service as other parts of the county. And of course, it is a more rural part of the county, but that's not an excuse. We do need to do a better job. And I know that we had, after the first day or two of the rapid test kits distribution, I know that HHS specifically made a trip up to Poolesville in order to be able to disperse those. I'll have to follow up and find out what the issue is with the masks, because that shouldn't be an issue. We have enough resources to bear to be able to make sure that we hand them out to individuals in Poolesville, and I'll follow up on that immediately after this show.
You heard that, Claire? You can follow up on his follow-up. Here's Tom Sherwood.
Mr. Council President, you're the rotating council president for this year. Vice President is Evan Glass, who is the first gay person to hold that seat, and I assume will be the president next year. But you're in this seat. You're running for re-election. There is the expanded council elections to add two district level seats to the council. There's a hot executive race, and there are the congressional races where the Democrats are okay in Maryland, but not so good around the country. Mm-hmm. Is there one thing you want to get done in the year ahead in this swirl of politics in every corner, whether it's the COVID crisis, whether it's the elections that surround you, whether it's your own election? What is your, if you can say it, principal number one goal as president of the council for this year?
Sure. Well, with that description, Tom, you're making me want to take a nap, because you're right. It is
you can join the great resignation and quit.
Yeah, but yes, I do have priorities, and there are two in particular. One, I've had the great fortune of chairing our county's Health and Human Services Committee for the last 3 years, and so I really want to shine a spotlight and focus on addressing some of those underlying health issues that led to the really, frankly, immoral discrepancies that we've seen as a result of the pandemic. And so that will be a significant area of focus. That will include things like expanding telehealth and telemedicine opportunities, and also closing the digital divide so that people can take advantage of those telehealth and telemedicine opportunities. It also will look like expanding meeting patients where they are, by expanding mobile medical opportunities, because we know public health is inextricably linked to all of us. Somebody's health in Wheaton matters to someone's health in Potomac and vice versa. So we need to connect some dots there. And the second area that I want to focus on is in the area of food insecurity. And I love, Tom, the last time I was on, when I mentioned that term, you said that means people who are hungry. Yes. And you are right. It is a term that it doesn't do justice to the devastation that families feel when they're in that situation. But the great news is, over the last 2 years, with an infusion of federal resources, with a number of organizations that have emerged, and with the infrastructure that we already had through remarkable nonprofit organizations and the Food Council, I think we're at a point where we can, with the right strategic plan and the right direction, effectively end childhood hunger in our community.
Would that mean? Does that mean that on any given day of the week, any family with children would have access to food in some capacity?
That's exactly right. But beyond that, making sure that the food is of quality, that it is culturally appropriate, that it's something that kids will actually eat. But to get there, we're going to need help from our federal partners. And there's a movement afoot right now for something called universal lunches, getting away from the free and reduced meal model that, you know, requires somebody to fill out some forms and, you know, can be a real stigma for families. This would level the playing field and put us in a much better position to be able to address the needs of families. But beyond just literally providing food to all kids when they need it and when they want it, it also means addressing the issues that led to food insecurity in the first place. And so it's all connected: workforce development, affordable housing, an accessible transportation network. All of this is inextricably linked. So
yeah, you've got one year as president.
The focus is going to be on literally feeding kids, but also addressing those underlying issues.
1 year as president.
Well, it's going to be to engage and initiate a plan that over time we're going to get to. But as long as I'm on this council, I'm going to make sure that we achieve that.
Here's Ann in Chevy Chase. Ann, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I think the county is ignoring those of us who are elderly, can't drive, and or are physically unable to get to the sites to pick up tests and masks. What do you plan to do about that? I think it seems like nobody's doing anything about that.
Gabe Albanos.
Sure. Well, great question, Ann. This for context, has been an ongoing challenge since the beginning of the pandemic. And you're right that we can't just expect people, especially those that are in are frail and elderly seniors, people with disabilities who can't, or people who just don't have access to the same transportation network. So we have worked with a number of nonprofit organizations and providers to be able to expand our reach. And we will make sure that we do that. We've also been working with our faith-based organizations too, which have been really strong partners to be able to go deeper into communities. So I think, Anne, that's going to have to be the answer, is going deeper through the existing partnerships with nonprofits that we have and going deeper into communities. And in Chevy Chase, that could also look like partnering with our municipal partners in the town.
Is there a agency within the county government that a senior citizen or someone working with a senior citizen could call for the kind of help that she just
there
discussed?
There is. If you call 311, it's sort of the catch-all number, but our Department of Health and Human Services has a division of aging and disabilities that is a really terrific department and has been addressing a number of issues, both big and small, since the beginning of the pandemic. And so I would suggest calling 311, and they would put in touch with that particular department, division of the Department of Health and Human Services.
This tweet comes from the Twitter account Concerned Moco. Can you ask Gabe why the county's privatized economic development organization, which is funded 100% by county tax dollars, isn't required to have publicly accessible meetings?
So what the question's referring to is our Montgomery County Economic Development Corporation, which he's right, was privatized from the county's public Department of Economic Development. And Councilmember Glass actually had pending legislation to require formally in law that all of MCEDC's meetings be public. But our understanding is that there have been great strides made by MCEDC and that their meetings now are in fact publicly shown. I'll have to follow up to confirm that that's been enacted, but I know that we pulled that legislation specifically because of some moves that MCEDC had made on their own that satisfied the concerns of Councilmember Glass and my colleagues.
I want to ask you about the governor's race.
About to say he's not going to ask you about the county executive race because he knows what your answer is going to be on that, so he's moving to the governor's race.
We'll see how you play that out. But the governor's race, there's a lot of Montgomery County connections to the candidates for governor. But a lot of the power in the General Assembly is shifted to the Baltimore region. Do you have any sense of where you'll be on the governor's race as the president? Do you feel like you can endorse someone for governor, or are you just not going to?
Sure. Well, I actually have publicly endorsed Tom Perez in that race.
I've known
Tom a long time, and he's a mentor to me. But there are tremendous candidates in that race, and so not unlike the 4th District race for Congress, I think the state will be in good hands. But I think Tom's unique experience of local, state, and government at the local, state, and federal level is significant, because whoever wins is going to be able to have to hit the ground running from day one, because there are so many issues that the governor is going to face.
Here's Lori in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Lori, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I just wanted to comment about the student walkout. My son goes to Montgomery Blair High School in Silver Spring, and we received a notice from the principal that students, teachers, and leadership met with student leadership, and they reached an agreement, and students were permitted to do a walkout today, and they would not be marked absent as long as they had permission from their parents in advance.
What is your response to that, Gabe Aronis?
Well, I think that's good news. I'm glad that there were some conversations in advance that give our kids a long enough runway to be able to express their opinion and do it within reason. I think that's a good thing.
Thank you very much for your call. Devin sent us an email. So far, we've had numerous snow days, and I asked the lead teacher at our school-based child care center if they got paid on those days, since parents do not get a refund. She said they do not get paid on those days. Is there anything that could be done to make sure that they receive payments, since us parents are paying for the care?
I'm going to have to follow up on that. I don't know the answer to that question. There have been more snow days just in the last 3 weeks than there were all of last year. And I think, you know, compensation is important, so I'll look into that.
Maryland lawmakers are busy in Annapolis right now. In addition to the budget, legislators will be taking up bills on many issues, including redistricting, marijuana legalization, and more. Have you spoken with members of the Montgomery County delegation about the priorities that you'd like to see pushed through?
We have. There's a standing formal meeting that we have with the delegation at the beginning of each session where the county talks about their priorities, and I just want to extend my deep appreciation to our delegation, which always does an outstanding job. And this year, who would have known, but we're going to have more resources to bear than we certainly thought we were going to have at the beginning of the pandemic, which affords us some flexibility. So there are certainly capital projects that we're going to want to see advance. A big priority remains our school system and investments there, but there is one piece of legislation that I'm personally tracking closely that I'm hoping passes in Annapolis this year, and that's around the issue of ghost guns, which, you know, just a couple of years ago, I had no idea what a ghost gun was until it was explained to me, and it has since become a huge issue. These are weapons that are manufactured out of fiberglass or plastic. You can purchase them online. They come
only have about 30
partially
seconds
constructed, and so there is a legislation at the state level right now looking to ban them in the state, and I strongly support that. We pass local legislation using what's called a zone text amendment, but it only goes so far. We need the state's help with this.
Gabe Aronis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor.
He's the president of the Montgomery County Council. Tom Sherwood, any big plans this weekend?
I'm just trying to get through the COVID thing like everybody else. I'm very happy that the numbers are going down. I hope that's good news for late winter.
Same here. You have a safe weekend. And thank you all for listening, and you stay safe. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Nandi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Inga-Lisa Schrobsdorf. Kellen Quigley is our engineer, and our broadcast engineer is Adrian Danhauser. Today's phone screener was Nancy Gaius. Monica Ashby oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.